Okay, well, I'm pleased to be here at the ITP to begin the IGM workshop. And I agreed to give this talk 2 days ago on the grounds that with so little time, I couldn't prepare it. So I'm.
Famous quote.
What's that?
That everyone who has a PhD should be able to give a talk on 30 minutes' notice.
I see. Well, I do, and I did. Will. Okay, so I'm going to talk about reionization and the end of the cosmic dark ages, and I'm going to focus on the problem of taking account of small-scale structure in modeling reionization, and the possibility of detecting that small-scale structure by its 21-centimeter background contribution from before reionization. So, for those of you who are here who are not aficionados of reionization, I'm just going to give the very briefest of introduction. We know that the universe has been highly ionized at redshifts less than 6. Because when we observe the spectrum of quasars, we don't see the telltale absorption trough extending to the blue of the emission line in Lyman alpha of the quasar, called the Gunn-Peterson effect. We have upper limits. We see a Lyman alpha forest of absorption lines due to an inhomogeneous clumpy intergalactic medium. But when we model that, it's clear that it's a highly ionized gas, where the ionized fraction is about 1 part in 10 to the 5. The neutral fraction, I should say, is about 1 part in 10 to the 5. The Gunn-Peterson effect, however, has been detected now with the discovery of quasars at redshifts greater than 6 in the Sloan Digital Sky Survey. And those detected Gunn-Peterson troughs imply a neutral hydrogen density high enough to suggest that the reionization of the universe had only just ended at about a redshift of 6. And if this were a talk for a more general audience, I'd show you the spectra and we'd talk about the nuances of that, but I won't. Well, that was the situation until last year, that somehow reionization was a thing that was ending at a redshift of 6. But the WMAP detection of a fluctuating polarization in the cosmic microwave background on large angular scales implied that there was foreground electron scattering with an optical depth large enough to require that the universe be full of electrons in the intergalactic medium all the way back to a redshift as high as 12. And that if it was only ionized since a redshift of 6, there wouldn't have been enough electron scattering to explain that. So this has posed a puzzle. How did the universe finish its reionization at a redshift of 6 when it seemed already to be well advanced in its ionization at a redshift greater than 12? So the plausible explanation, which is not an explanation, but it's sort of a cartoon in search of an explanation, is that somehow reionization began by a redshift greater than 15, but was extended in time with a final overlap of ionized zones at a redshift of 6. And this is a puzzle for the theory of reionization, because the standard description of reionization involves the creation of ionized zones in the intergalactic medium as the first sources turned on, propagated ionization fronts into the intergalactic medium around them, and eventually the patches of ionized gas grew in size to overlap and complete reionization. And before that, the atoms inside any ionized zone only saw the radiation from the sources that were inside the ionized patch. And so there was a radiation that was ionizing them that was local. But once the overlap took place, the mean free path for the ionizing radiation from all the sources was orders of magnitude larger. And so in no time at all, atoms saw the ionizing ultraviolet background jump in intensity by orders of magnitude because of this increase in the mean free path. And that lowered any residual neutral hydrogen fraction to the level after reionization was complete. And the transition epoch was believed to be sharp. So while we could argue about changing the efficiency for releasing ionizing radiation and the rate at which the first collapsed objects form stars, we have to contend with the fact that the standard picture of reionization involves a rapid transition, whereas these two observations seem to be requiring that the transition be not rapid, prolonged. So the undertext of my talk will be that theme. And
I have a question.
Yeah.
So for these two methods, one of them is sensitive to very small fractions of neutral matter, and one of them is sensitive to very small fractions of ionized matter. So they catch the different fractions. So one says, okay, it's ionized, even though only a small fraction is ionized, and one says there is neutral matter, even though it's a small fraction. Is that why?
Well, one of them is an integral. That's not quite right. The polarization measurement is an integral over the electron fraction, and it is neither for a large electron fraction or a small electron fraction. It's the integral. So however you want to distribute that, whereas the Gunn-Peterson detection is sampling a small neutral fraction or a large neutral fraction, but it requires some neutral fraction significantly larger than at redshifts is found at redshifts less than 6. But it's a local measure, not an integral. Okay, so now I'm going to talk about the effect of the presence of small-scale structure during this process of reionization, which gets in the way of the expanding ionization fronts and may contribute to an explanation for this prolonged reionization. But in any case, it's going to happen, and it hasn't been incorporated in all the theoretical treatments of reionization, and it has to be. And I'm going to argue that it has a strong effect.
Actually, before I go there, how long would the simple model take to reionize the universe? If it was going strong at 12, would it be done by 11 and a half?
It would take an interval of delta z over z in redshift, about 0.1. So, point number one, for the current concordance model, the lambda CDM universe, we know that the universe at a redshift greater than 6 was already filled with mini halos capable of trapping a piece of the global intergalactic ionization fronts which reionize the universe and photoevaporating their gaseous baryons back into the IGM. And here, the term mini-halos, for me, will refer to halos for which the virial temperature is less than 10,000 degrees. And in that case, in the absence of a source of ionizing radiation, collisional ionization is all that can ionize the gas, and the temperature is too low for that gas to be collisionally ionized, so those halos are full of neutral hydrogen. And what I'm showing you here, in order to illustrate this point, are projections of simulations, n-body simulations, which were 1 megaparsec on a side co-moving today, so 100 kiloparsecs on a side at a redshift of 9. And we took the n-body simulations. We then made a catalog of all of the virialized halos in them. And there are about 3,000 halos in this box, down to a mass something under 100,000 solar masses. And we divided the population of halos into those which have a virial temperature above 10,000 degrees and those which have a virial temperature below 10,000 degrees. On the right, we have the mini halos. On the left, we have the halos hotter than 10,000 degrees. And there are about 20 of them in the box on the left, and there are a few thousand on the box on the right. And I need to add, for those of you who are not aficionados, that the distinction I make between mini halos and the halos with higher virial temperature is also relevant to the question of which halos provided the predominant source of ionizing radiation by forming stars and other luminous objects like mini quasars. There is a body of evidence which suggests that when the first fraction of the gas in the mini halos began to release ionizing radiation, it also released, of course, photodissociating radiation, and the key ingredient for forming stars in them had to be the formation of a trace of hydrogen molecules, because without hydrogen molecules, the primordial composition gas can't cool itself below 10,000 degrees. And if it can't cool, it can't make lumps inside the mini halos, which are self-gravitating, which lead to star formation. So when the first fraction of them begin to form stars, they release a copious amount of photodissociating radiation, which has a much longer mean free path than the ionizing radiation. And they quickly build up a background which spoils it and sterilizes the rest of the mini halos. That's the simple picture. There are nuances, as the experts in the room know, which could be loopholes in that argument. But that's the point of view I'm going to take for simplicity here. So these are the ones that are sterile, neutral mini halos, filled with neutral gas. But these, because they're hotter than 10,000 degrees, atomic line cooling serves to cool them, and they can form stars, even in the presence of photodissociating radiation.
What does the symbol size represent?
So the symbol size here actually represents the size of the halos. So in place of each halo, we put a sphere of the size of the virial radius of the halo. And just to show you that if we had enough resolution to continue seeing even down to smaller scales, we take a corner of this box, we simulate a 50 kiloparsec box, and we've also done that with a 25 kiloparsec box, and now we've even done it with a larger box, but which has all the resolution of all three together. But when I did this plot, we stitched them together. And to show you that all the way down to the smallest mass halos that incorporate baryons, the so-called Jeans mass, which is about 10,000 solar masses, the sky continues to be covered. And this volume, as you can see, is, you know, one-eighth of that volume, and so on. So just to give you a three-dimensional view of that volume, the shaded contours here show the gas density at a contour level which is about twice the mean density. And in the position where we located halos, we put a sphere whose size is equal to the size of the virialized halo and whose color codes the mass. The color red indicates masses greater than 100 solar masses, 100 million solar masses, excuse me. So those would be the potential source halos of ionizing radiation. And the rest of them are the mini halos. White corresponds to 10 to the 7 solar masses, and down to blue corresponds to something under 100,000 solar masses. And now I'm going to fly you through that volume so you get a sense of the cosmic web and the sense in which the cosmic web...
This is Z equals 9.
So this is... You could either think of this as the dark matter structure of the universe even after reionization, if... I guess it doesn't matter. We can... Should I turn it? Yeah. Oh, I see. There's just a switch, huh? No. That's fine. Good enough.
So are the blue filaments roughly an overdensity of 1?
2. And we stop for a moment at a red ball here. As we rotate, it'll come back. Think of that as the biggest source in this volume. And you can see that the sky around that source is covered with mini halos. And as we stop on the source halo, and look across, and the mini halos, by the way, follow the filamentary structure of the cosmic web with filaments and sheets. Here's a potential source, about 100 million times the mass of the sun, and we're going to look across the box at a target, which presumably would be ionized by an ionization front from that source. This is 10 to the 7 solar masses, and in what's to come, I'm going to show you how we simulate the effect of the encounter of the ionization front from the red ball, or something like it, with the white ball. And I guess you could turn the lights up.
How many Milky Way masses are we looking at in total there?
In total, it's a fraction, more than a tenth and less than one of the Milky Way. As it would have looked, you know, when the universe was only a couple hundred billion years old, or of that order. So now, statistically, we take that sample of the catalog of halos, we carve out a sphere around a random point, which is 25 kiloparsecs on a side. We project it onto the sky, we ask what fraction of the sky is covered. From a random location in this simulation, it's about 11%. But it's been known for some time that if you sit on a halo, then there is a bias, which means that it's more likely to find other halos nearby. So if you sit on that red ball and ask what's the covering fraction of the sky around that ball, then within that radius of 25 kiloparsecs, it's almost a quarter of the sky covered by the mini halos around that ball. This is a point which was also made in a paper by Heyman, Madow, and Abel, or Heyman, Abel, and Madow. Here I'm going to plot for you the fraction of the sky covered by mini halos located within the mean volume per source halo, corrected for this bias, and I'm going to plot it versus the mass of the source halo. Of course, the more massive the source halo, the more rare they are in space, so there's a bigger volume between them. And what you can see is that if I tell you that above 10 to the 8 solar masses are the population of source halos, because those are the ones with virial temperature greater than 10,000 degrees, they all have a covering fraction bigger than unity. And it is not bigger than unity late, but less than unity early, when things are not yet collapsed out. You'll see that even at a redshift of 19, the covering fraction around all of these sources is greater than 1. So that means that the picture in which ionization fronts propagate outward around sources through the intergalactic medium, sweeping outward until they overlap with their neighbors and complete reionization, which doesn't put in the mini halos, has got it wrong. That picture is wrong. It has to take into account the effect of the mini halos. Now, what the effect of the mini halos is, I'm going to tell you. But the other thing to ponder at this point, and I'll come back to it in the 21 centimeter background prediction, because it's going to turn out that the same mini halos, before they're zapped by the ionization fronts from the sources during reionization, are potential sources of 21 centimeter emission, create a fluctuating background from the dark ages before any sources have turned on. And this, you can anticipate being an interesting effect, and also imagine other effects if mini halos are present when sources of absorption that we could see absorption spectra are seen behind them. This is the number of mini halos per unit redshift at these different redshifts, and you can see the number per unit redshift is hundreds. If I take the total number from the end of reionization at Z min equals 6 up to some Z max, and I ask how many of them are there along a random line of sight through the universe, then if Z max is 20, there are thousands of these things along any line of sight. And this...
Take home this pointer. It might be easier back behind
it. Oh, thanks. A real pointer, okay.
What is the optical depth of one of these mini halos?
They are in, it depends on in what quantity. In, for example, in Lyman alpha resonance scattering, the same thing that produces the Gunn-Peterson effect when it's distributed in the intergalactic medium. They have about 10 to the 20 atoms per centimeter squared. And of course, there's a range of masses for them. And I'm telling you 10 to the 7 solar mass, sort of canonical one. And so this is so large in optical depth that you would see the damping wings of the Lorentz profile. The radiative damping wings, rather. So they would look like damp Lyman alpha absorbers. So extremely optically thick.
In Lyman alpha, but for photoionization, it would be less than that, right?
Yes, but still completely, okay. Yeah. Sorry, that's probably what I should have said simply. Okay.
It's only 21 centimeters that they're optically thin.
Yeah, but even there, they're not overwhelmingly optically thin, and I'll show the optical depth actually, but it's certainly optically thin. Okay, so with my collaborators Ilyan Ilyov and Alex Raga, we have zoomed in on the encounter between a cosmological ionization front and a single mini halo in order to simulate the effect with hydrodynamics that includes radiative transfer when the intergalactic ionization front encounters the mini halo. And here I just want to define the term. In the intergalactic medium, the ionization fronts move supersonically on average, both with respect to the gas that's neutral ahead of them and the ionized gas behind them. So they race ahead of the hydrodynamical back reaction of the gas. And actually, that fact is underlying most of the analysis of reionization theoretically that adopts some description of the density field in the universe and lets sources light up and then just assumes that the matter sits there until it's swept over by ionizing radiation, and don't have to ask what is this feedback, how is this feedback. But what's going to happen is that when that weak R-type ionization front encounters the density enhancement of a mini halo, which is optically thick to ionizing radiation, it slows it down and it traps the ionization front, and the ionization front converts from an R-type, which races ahead of the hydrodynamic response, to a D-type, which moves subsonically through the gas in the mini halo and evaporates it, but where the gas dynamics and the ionization front dynamics are inextricably bound. So here is just a set of time slices of the temperature where, just to orient you again, the source is out to the left of the simulation volume, and we zoom in on the mini halo in the center of the box. At time t equals 0, 0.2 megayears, 2.5, 10, 60, and 150 megayears for a mini halo, which is 10 to the 7 times the solar mass at a redshift of 9, with a flux which is very typical of the flux that would be exposing the mini halos to ionizing radiation. And so I've non-dimensionalized it in terms of this canonical flux. So in those units, it's 1. And it happens that that would correspond, for example, to a source that emits 10 to the 56 ionizing photons at a distance of a megaparsec, or one that emits 10 to the 52 ionizing photons per second at a distance of 10 kiloparsecs. And I'm assuming for this illustration that the spectrum of the source is that of starlight from POP2 stars. And what you see is, first, the black is the neutral and cold intergalactic medium as the weak R-type ionization front sweeps across the mini halo, ionizing the intergalactic medium and heating it up to 10,000 degrees outside. And then as it enters the mini halo, it slows down. There's a shadow behind the mini halo. The red is the virialized gas that is still neutral. So in that case, it was a few thousand degrees, but it's still neutral. And it eats its way in. I'm going to show you a movie of that.
Oh, this is an isolated halo, so this is not a cosmological density field.
This is a cosmological density field, but it's not a Gaussian random noise generated one. But what I mean by that is, there is cosmological infall onto the halo. The IGM at some distance is expanding. But within some radius, there's a turnaround and things are falling down onto the halo in a cosmologically consistent way. And inside the virial radius, it is modeled in a way which is very similar to the average n-body halo results for CDM. In this case, I use the truncated isothermal sphere model, but it is...
So
there are no filaments outside this, no. It's spherically symmetric, and the imposition of a point source out here turns it into an axisymmetric problem. So here's a time slice 60 megayears later, after the source, the arrival of the ionization front, and this is the density isocontours, this bullet shape of the neutral gas and the shadow behind it. The velocity arrows show you the sense in which there's this supersonic wind, where the longest arrows are about 25 kilometers a second, and the shortest are about 3 kilometers a second. The solid boundary shows you the Lagrangian boundary of the gas that started out in hydrostatic equilibrium inside the mini-halo before it was hit by the ionization front, and now it's expanding outward. And the dashed line is the boundary of the ionization front.
The escape velocity is what, a few kilometers per second?
Yes, exactly. So if I cut through that, if I cut along the axis to plot the gas dynamical properties, then you can see distinct features. This is pressure isocontours after the same 60 megayears. And what I want to, I'll just label them according to the temperature plot and describe them. As you move from the source side towards the mini halo, first you encounter a shock where the expanding wind has swept up the intergalactic medium and shock heated it. That's at one. At two, there's a contact discontinuity, which separates the shocked halo wind between two and three from the swept up intergalactic medium between one and two. At three, there is a wind shock, which thermalizes the wind coming out from behind the ionization front, which is located at four. Between three and four is the supersonic wind. There's a shock at this point. At five, you see the boundary of gas that was initially inside the mini halo at a redshift of nine. At six, you see a shock in the shadow region, which is caused by the compression of the shadow gas by shock heated gas outside the shadow. And the plots of neutral hydrogen and the helium and the optical depth, actually, this is a good way to answer your question about optical depth. I show the optical depth at the threshold for ionizing hydrogen, helium 1 and helium 2. So the solid line is for hydrogen, and you can see that even after 60 megayears, what's left of the mini halo neutral gas has an optical depth which is like 10 to the 5, highly optically thick, through the middle. Yeah.
Idealized isotropic radiation field, would you get full evaporation or would you get compression? Because you know when you change compression,
yeah, no,
you
we,
get compression.
In all of our experience, there is no sign of any effect like Renu-Chan predicted. Now, we haven't put the idealized degenerate geometry of an isotropic flux, first of all, because that will never happen. But what we expected to have happen is to see some trend along the direction of the line from the source to the center. There's no reason for it to be special to spherical symmetry. And we don't see any such effect. And we've considered a wide range of parameter space. So I think that's just wrong. And the reason it's wrong is that there's this enormous pressure gradient in the gravitationally supported pressure hydrostatic equilibrium initial condition of the mini halo. And so the ionization front has to climb up this huge pressure gradient And there is no sense in which it drives the gas inward. It just sort of stalls when it runs up that pressure gradient. And just to show you an animation of that process.
But how does the time scale for eating into that compare to the sound travel time across the region?
It's which region? You have to be careful. The wind is blowing out supersonically. So from the Lagrangian point of view of a fluid element encountered by the front,
yes.
It's actually expanding faster than sound crossing time, which actually plays an important role in reducing the consumption of ionizing photons from what you might have naively thought. But the actual velocity of the front is subsonic.
So if you're sitting at the center?
If you're sitting at the center, you don't know nothing until something comes and reaches you.
But then that implies that it's supersonic, not subsonic. That's why I'm asking. So if you're at the center and it were supersonic, what you said would be right. If it's subsonic,
well,
then the center can just expand out. That's what I'm trying to understand,
yeah,
which way,
yeah,
it goes.
I mean, yeah. Yeah, it's both. It's both. The time it takes for the disturbance to reach the center is long because it's very subsonic. Okay? But once it reaches the center, then it's all coupled. Okay? So the region that is affected by the disturbance is then expelled supersonically. But it's so it's both at the same time. Okay. So let me just play for you. Okay, so you see the ionization front sweep in under a mega year through the box, which was about 10 kiloparsecs across. And then there is this transformation to the dynamical phase. And the dynamical phase not only blows the wind out, but leaves behind a hole. And in this case, for a POP2 spectrum, it took a couple hundred mega years. And it started at a redshift 9, and it ended at a redshift of 7.21. Okay, so I think I'm not going to show you. I can always come back to show you more movies. But
just ask a few questions, just
yeah,
so that I understand. The one is, in particular, it's a movie. I saw a kind of extended temperature gradient as the front is approaching.
Well, remember that, I don't know what you're referring to.
So this blue wave.
The blue wave is an adiabatically cooled hole, okay? As the wind expels the gas from the... Yeah?
At the very initial phase. Maybe go back to your stills. To power my slides back.
Okay.
Yeah. Look at the...
Right,
this? Corner. This blue.
Yeah. Well.
But the why is it so extended?
I mean, why is it so spread out?
Yeah.
That's cold.
Why is it upheated?
Optical depth. It's the finite.
Yes.
It in the mini halo, the mean free path to ionizing radiation is small, so there's a sharp ionization front. But in the IGM, the density is so much lower that you're actually seeing the thickness of the ionization front.
Okay.
In fact, it's a challenge numerically to be able to,
one thing, you could easily get a similar effect if you have a diffusive cone.
Yes, but
you have a sharp front in this frame. That was a good
right.
Okay. Is it really a physical?
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. And in fact, before we put the mini, as a test of the code before we put the mini halo in, we put it in a uniform IGM and we checked that not only does the ionization front move at the right speed, but that it has the thickness of the number of mean free paths that it should for a steady front moving in a plane symmetric.
And then if I go to the lower right plot, but it looks pretty messy. Is that instability or?
There's this extremely interesting trend for the gas which is shock heated and outside of the mini halo,
yeah,
to have converging on the shadow region,
yeah,
just behind the mini halo, and it tends to kind of bounce and reflect and bounce and reflect and ablate the shadow. And so I don't know whether I should call that an instability.
But then that's the question. Is it just a messy reflection of shock waves?
I think so. In fact, if you
dimension geometry, or do you have something like an instability?
It's probably both. It's probably both, because there also are these kind of vortical things, and so it's probably that which I described, combined with the sense in which it's not just planar layers. But what I find fascinating about it is that you can actually see planar layers rippling off, even though it has this vertical thing combined. And it's very complicated. I don't have a good simple description of it. Okay, so now, what's that?
Are you talking about the POP3?
I'm going to get to sort of putting it all into the mix, but the bottom line is the POP3 doesn't look terribly different, but it is a little more efficient at finishing the evaporation. So it takes a little bit less time and uses up a somewhat less photons. So one way to summarize this for the canonical case we just saw the movie of is to ask how many ionizing photons are consumed per mini halo atom in the completion of its evaporation, because that's what we will need to put it into the back in the mix of global reionization to see how efficient that is. And what we found is that several ionizing photons are consumed in an evaporation time, and it doesn't much matter whether it's a quasar-like power law spectrum or a POP2 type spectrum, but if you have a POP3 type spectrum, which is intermediate in hardness between the two, this is somewhat more efficient. Instead of 5, it's 3 in this case. And then the universe is full of a full range of mini halo masses and exposed to different fluxes for different distances from the source. So we really needed to quantify that before we could put it into even a semi-analytical model of global reionization. So we then ran a large suite of simulations like that. And I'm not going to expect to say anything much about the details here, but in this paper was submitted just a few weeks ago, although we have had these results for a while. So I plot in the upper panel the evaporation time in megayears, and in the lower panel this same photons per atom consumption rate. And we varied three parameters in this matrix: the mass of the halo, the flux in units of that canonical flux that we just saw the details of, and the redshift at which the ionization front hits the halo. And we considered the full range of mini-halo masses from 10,000 up to 10 to the eighth. We considered a range of redshifts from a redshift of 6 up to about 20. We considered from 1% of this canonical flux up to 1,000 times that canonical flux. And the basic trend is that, though you might find it surprising, as you increase the flux, you increase the number of photons per atom consumed, even though you shrink the evaporation time. And that has something to do with the fact that the faster the ionization front moves, the in the D-type ionization front, the higher the density, the compression of the gas that results, and therefore the higher the recombination rate. But remember that from the back end, it's expanding supersonically, and so it doesn't sit there. And Piero may be puzzling over these numbers and why they're not 10 or 100 times larger, because in Heyman, Abel, and Madow, they had used the sound crossing time for the static initial density distribution and assumed that recombinations would take place continuously at that high density for about a sound crossing time, which would be the, you know, sort of the naive estimate of how long it would take to expand. And it turns out it's 1 to 2 orders of magnitude more efficient than that because of this supersonic ejection thing. It's as if nature made the most perfect machine for blocking ionizing radiation, but not using up too much to be zapped and evaporated. But we'll see. That's still much more than the average atom in the intergalactic medium by up to an order of magnitude. So we have to take that into account. So higher flux means higher consumption. Higher redshift, they're denser, you know, they're smaller, so they have higher consumption. Higher mass, there's more, they take longer to evaporate, and therefore they consume more. Okay. So now what's the effect of this on global reionization? So here we decided to go back to the semi-analytical approach, where one, and here I'm talking about work that includes Evans Kanapieko, and we considered individual source halos creating an expanding spherical ionization front. And to do this, and then we integrated over a statistical distribution of source halo masses and turn-on epochs to accumulate ionized volume until the volume overlapped. And the approach we took here started with the approach that I took in Shapiro and Giroux 1987, where you start with a point source and you consider in the expanding intergalactic medium how fast the ionization front expands. It's not a Sturmgren sphere. I'll take a moment to give you my my admonition to stop using the term cosmological Sturmgren spheres. A Sturmgren sphere, as everyone who studies the interstellar medium knows, is an equilibrium object. It's a sphere whose radius encloses the volume that you would fill with atoms such that there are just enough atoms recombining per second, if it's all ionized, to balance the number of ionizing photons leaving the central source. But the cosmological ionization front never fills its Sturmgren sphere. The density is dropping continuously. If it's in the weak R-type limit that I said it was, it is not large enough to fill the Sturmgren sphere. So it shouldn't be called a Sturmgren sphere. It's a spherical ionization front. And we then had to say, well, what do we do with the ionization front in the presence of mini halos? All those details that we had to simulate in such as such effort, one halo at a time. And now we've got a gas that's going to be filled with that complicated mix. So what we did was to take the ionizing consumption, the consumption rate of ionizing photons, and modify the ionization front jump condition so that the rate of expansion of the ionization front was the rate you would get if you wasted ionizing photons evaporating mini halos. And so for each ionized hydrogen atom that makes it from the neutral side across to the ionized side, it's not just one photon that it takes to do it, it's several, because some of those are being used to evaporate the mini halo. And then we can proceed with the analytical prescription for the spherical ionization front and then stitch them together statistically. And here we had to do something subtle, which Evan was an expert at, which was figure out what the statistical bias of stacking shells of mini halos around each point source was as a function of the mass of the source halo and the radius of the ionization front as it changed with time. And when we did that, we found that the bottom line is that mini halos did increase photon consumption over the universe with no mini halos by about a factor of 2 and delayed reionization by a delta Z of order 2. And so it...
And this is the best case, I mean, it's well, the worst case. You're assuming mini halos are only passive here in terms of UV photon
yes.
production.
That's right.
They're just clumping.
They're just
the galactic acid
that's right. They're blocking the path of the ionization fronts, and they're sucking up photons.
So if they had internal sources,
then they would be consuming those photons, but they would not be consuming the photons from another source. So from the more massive sources, they would then, you know.
But in what sense would it go? Suppose mini halos are sources of radiation instead of just sources of opacity, then presumably the radiation that they produce to escape into the intergalactic medium must go through the denser layer.
Oh, I see.
Of the mini halo.
Yes. So, there are two ways to look at it then. If the mini halos are sources, then they're additional sources that weren't counted when we counted only the more massive halos. And those additional photons will also take care of the consumption by the mini halos. So that the photons from the larger source halos don't have to be wasted. However, you're right, the presence of the dense mini halo gas surrounding the source will eat up a lot of those internal photons. Okay, but in the meantime, just to break it down for you, because there are actually two effects that we worried about. There are the mini halos, but also the gas outside of mini halos is clumpy, those filaments that Piero was asking about. And to be fair, one needs to take into account both. And the simulations of reionization have often not had the resolution not only to include the mini halos, but to get the clumping factor right for gas outside. So typically, the effect of that clumpy gas outside the mini halos is to increase the recombination rate, which increases the opacity of the intergalactic medium and slows the expansion of the ionization fronts, even though the ionization front remains a weak R-type. But nevertheless, if the clumpiness is significant, then the consumption will go up. So we needed to add that effect also. And first we parameterized it crudely. C equals zero just means there's no intergalactic medium to recombine. And we tuned the release of ionizing radiation per source halo so that it had a constant mass to light ratio for the source halos, simple assumption. And we tuned the luminosity, the efficiency for creating stars, so that when there was no intergalactic medium at all, we got an overlap at of order 15 or 16 or 17. No, I guess 15 or 16. And then we said, but now put the intergalactic medium in with no mini halos. And the solid lines are the no mini halo case. Then there is a slowing down of the expansion because the intergalactic medium does recombine and waste some photons. And then we said, but actually the clumpiness outside the mini halos, even with no mini halos accounted for, is more like a clumping factor of 10 than 1, although that's an average, and we're going to do that better in a second. And in that case, the overlap is much delayed until less than 10. And so you might think that if there was only some way to make this clumping factor high late and low early, then maybe I could tilt this curve so that it started to accumulate electron fraction here to satisfy the integrated WMAP detection of polarization, but didn't overlap there to screw up the Gunn-Peterson, instead coasted in there to overlap. So the electron scattering optical depth might be high enough to satisfy WMAP, and the late overlap might be high enough to satisfy the Gunn-Peterson. That was the hope. And in fact, we actually started by hoping that both effects, the mini halos and the clumping, would go in the same direction. Because the clump, they're both arising from the structure formation. And the universe is rapidly forming more and more structure, especially on these small scales. So the time-dependent effect seemed to go in just the right direction. And sure enough, if I added the mini halos, even with a constant clumping factor, but with the mini halos treated not with bias taken into account, but just the average collapse fraction of the mini halos grows with time, there is a tilting compared to the no mini halo case. But in fact, we found that it wasn't enough with that constant clumping factor to satisfy both the Kunn-Peterson and WMAP. The prolonged reionization required still requires something else to change. Either the radiation release efficiency has to go down with time, or now with something we did check and I'm going to show you next, or the gas clumping outside the mini halos must rise over time, or both. So then we put in,
or WMAP's wrong.
Although
it was also speaker to bet on the outcome of the second year release.
Well, my colleague Eiichiro Komatsu is responsible for the second year. I mean, he's on the WMAP team and knows intimately the first year results, but is also responsible for the polarization results for second year. And although I must, I mean, don't get excited, he hasn't told me, he can't tell me yet, but he has told me when I have said to him, I have said to him, Eiichiro, you know, have a heart. I'm spending an enormous amount of time directing my research on the premise that this is something we need to explain. Shouldn't I? You know, I mean, should I do something else? and he said, no, don't change, you know, don't drop it.
I think we need more data about your relationship with this person.
He's my esteemed colleague. And if we were any more, if he were any more esteemed, I wouldn't be allowed to talk about it in public.
That seems to have the same weight that what a striker told me in Cambridge. He said, see, Piero, Spengel knows the answer. If it was wildly different than year one, he would be very depressed. And I don't see him depressed. So it's probably the same that he was.
You've got it. Right.
So he said, based on this sociological argument, I don't expect huge differences. But we'll see who is right.
I believe that's
it. Probably David's being abused all his colleagues, basically.
Trying to interpret his mood.
All right, so we're going to continue to worry about this until we're told otherwise. So the next question was, what is that time-varying clumping factor which is going to increase with time? And you might think, God, this is ancient history. It must be known. We just look it up. But whenever anyone has calculated the clumpiness of the universe, they've always taken into account all of the matter, mini halos included, source halos included, and if they weren't resolving the smallest scale halos, then they weren't even getting an adequate answer. So we had the advantage that since we had zoomed in simulating a small volume, and we don't care about variance as we move around the universe, we just want the average effect, then since we have a catalog of mini halos and we know how big the mini halos are, we can excise every mini halo and consider the clumpiness of all the gas outside of the mini halos. And that's what we did, and we plotted it. And at a redshift of 50, not surprising, the clumpiness is in the linear regime. But by redshift before 30, it's nonlinear. And by a redshift of 10, it's up to about 8, and by the end of reionization, it would be greater than 10. And so we put that time-varying clumpy factor in.
Sorry, Paul, I have to say this. In your simulation, you don't have gas.
We have done simulations.
Not in the one you...
The one I plotted, there is no gas. So however, I have done simulations now with gas.
Okay.
And
so
they follow each other.
That
clumping factor was calculated from the simulations that were n-body simulations.
So it doesn't have the gene smoothing from early reionization?
We don't resolve below the gene's mass. No.
So you're assuming each mini halo has the structure?
I meant to say the smallest mini halos we resolve are above the gene's mass in the intergalactic medium. So therefore, there isn't anything we are assuming collapsed out that wouldn't have collapsed out if we had pressure for the gas.
But even if it's above the gene's mass, the structure of the mini halo will be different.
But that doesn't matter. All I cared about was that I could excise the mini halo for this. I'm not looking at the mini halos when I do this.
It's just that, so if you want to photo evaporate that mini halo, you just need a lot fewer photons.
Well, that's a separate issue. You're questioning whether the internal profile of some mass range of the mini halos should have been flatter than we took. But you know, we already took the TIS profile, not the NFW, so it's already flatter. And we could talk about that detail, but it's going to get lost at this moment. Because then you have to ask yourself what part of the consumption is dominated by the smallest mass halos instead of the biggest mass. It's not going to change the answer much. Okay.
But how much is the clumping factor dependent on your resolution, mass or size?
I don't know how to answer that. It was converged to the level that we needed it. If I simulated something with n-body simulations without gas to smaller substructure than the gene's length, I mean the gene's mass, then I would get too much clumpiness and it would not be the correct answer. But because we stopped at that scale, the things above it are correctly resolved, and so I think that's, but actually this is why we are doing the we've done the simulation with the gas and we are recalculating.
Is the gene's mass at the temperature after the gas has been ionized?
No.
Or it's
before? No, before.
Okay.
So the assumption here is that as the ionization fronts move into neutral gas, they are seeing the unfiltered intergalactic medium. And and this is consistent with numerical simulations. If you watch the movies of people like Gnedden, you see that the regions that are ionized are the same, and they just grow in a random way, but they grow until they overlap. They don't grow, disappear, another one appears over there, another one reappears there. So that assumption that the fronts are moving into virgin forest is the assumption that justifies. Okay, so the bottom line then is that when you put that time-varying clumping in, if the mini halos were not biased, the combination of time-varying clumping with unbiased mini halos does flatten the slope of the rise of the ionized fraction in just the way that you would like to explain the early rise and slow completion of reionization. However, the mini halos are biased. And when you put the bias in so that the mini halos are clustered around sources, then the boost that you get is diminished, because it turns out that in the H2 regions around source halos, even at the highest redshift, the collapsed fraction in mini halos inside the H2 region is about the same at all redshifts. Somewhat surprising. You would think that you'd have rare mini halos when everything was rare at early times. And as the collapsed fraction is growing rapidly, you'd have a lot more mini halos in the way at late times, which is what would flatten this. And it does in the unbiased mini halos. But when you put the bias in, the mini halos have about the same effect, and it's substantial, but it's about the same effect at all times. So the moral of the story is that to satisfy both the Gunn-Peterson late overlap and the electron scattering accumulation for WMAP is going to require something like ionizing radiation release efficiency to drop over time, although it is helped by the time-dependent increase of clumping over time. And the main effect of the mini halos is to double the consumption rate of ionizing photons and to delay reionization by delta Z of order 2. Now, we haven't explored all of the possible nuances, as we make our semi-analytical calculations more elaborate, we may quantitatively change that, but I don't expect to qualitatively. So now I know we're going long because that's the nature of these things with discussion, but I just wanted to show you that the same mini halos before reionization, before the first sources of radiation turned on, can be possibly detected from the Dark Ages as sources of 21 centimeter background. And so how, tell me, you know, I'm down to zero time or something, but how... Oh, okay, that's fine, good. Is that okay?
Yeah, I think yeah, if you can do it in 5 minutes now, we can really discuss this, of course, during coffee.
Yeah, okay, but the pictures are, the pictures make it...
I'm sure
I'll give the bottom line.
We discuss.
I'll give the bottom line. So the bottom line is that it's been known for some time that neutral hydrogen in the intergalactic medium was a potential source of 21 centimeter emission. But most of the discussions start with the assumption that the pumping, which decouples the spin temperature of the hydrogen from the cosmic microwave background, is either Lyman alpha pumping due to some background radiation, ultraviolet radiation, or a combination of Lyman alpha pumping with some general heating of the intergalactic medium that is somehow able to partially ionize but leave most of the gas neutral, but heat it so that the collisional pumping and the and/or the Lyman alpha pumping will decouple the spin temperature. So what is novel about what I'm describing here was the realization that if you go inside a mini halo before there are any sources of radiation, then the mere fact that the gas has been virialized to a high temperature and packed together at a very overdense density is enough to make collisions decouple the spin temperature from the CMB and make the mini halo gas stand out in emission above the microwave background temperature. So the only purpose of these plots is to show that if the temperature is high enough and the density is high enough that you break the coupling of the spin temperature to the CMB and you find those conditions inside mini halos. So one can predict can take the universe of mini halos, mass function of mini halos, calculate for each individual mini halo what the luminosity would be in 21 centimeter emission, integrate through mini halos, taking account of their optical depth, and you get a background which is at the millikelvin level. So that's the summary, and this over a broad range of redshift, few millikelvin. And in the bottom panel is expressed in terms of flux, but that's a detail. So we then simulated, that was an analytical calculation, and we were anxious to confirm that nonlinear clustering was not going to change the answer in a way which our analytical calculations didn't notice. So we also simulated the clustering of the mini halos and compared the results with statistical bias theory that Evans Kanapieko had worked out. And we confirmed that the linear fluctuations that we calculated for the mini halos on large angular scales was consistent with the effects taking into account nonlinear clustering. What I'm showing you here are maps. There's a bit of a cheat. These maps are only as deep in redshift space as a simulation volume. So we have a very small beam here, smaller than the radio arrays that are being planned to detect 21 centimeter fluctuations will be able to see. But it gives you a sense of the fluctuations you do have, which are very large, on small angles, 4 arcsecond beam in a 1 megaparsec box. And let me go down with the thing which is more realistic, which is to take tens of arc minutes as the beam width of the radio array and to consider the RMS fluctuation that the clustering of mini halos on large angle scales would produce in the mini-halo background. And again, we have a number which is a few millikelvin. It helps significantly that the mini-halos are biased, so their fluctuations are bigger than you would think from the fact that their collapse fraction is small at high redshift and grows to be substantial at low redshift. They're always boosted by bias in a way which the general intergalactic medium is not. And so let me just compare it to, so here we have a redshift dependent prediction. So you could think of this as a spectrum of redshifted 21 centimeter irradiation, or else you may think of it as the signal from different redshifts. And we compared it to very crude estimates of what low far and square kilometer array might be able to detect for 10 arc, for 9 arc minute and 25 arc minute beams. The point I want to make here is that there's only a rather slow decline in redshift for standard untilted power spectrum of primordial density fluctuations. And in words, what those plots were saying is that 3 sigma fluctuations should be observable with both low far and square kilometer array with integration times between 100 and 1,000 hours. And for a 25 arc minute beam example, these could be detected for untilted lambda CDM with both the 100 hour integration for Z between 6 and 7.5, if the universe still has neutral regions then, and 1,000 integration hour integration for a redshift less than of order 11.5, while for a 9 arc minute beam, the square kilometer array can detect them after 100 hours for a redshift less than of order 9, and after 1,000 hours for a redshift less than of order 13. And then I'm going to quickly give you two more punchlines. One is, as I alluded to before, there are so many of these mini-halos along the line of sight to any distant source that if there were strong radio sources at early redshifts, then the intervening medium would sample many mini-halos, some of which may still be neutral. And this was also calculated by Furlanetto and Loeb. And here we've taken our detailed calculations of individual mini-halos to show you that if you looked along the center chord of a mini-halo, a mass from the smallest mass up to the largest mass of the mini-halos, that the small ones are very optically thick at the center, optical depth of about, with a transmission of 20%, while 10 to the 6 solar mass mini-halos have a transmission which is about 90%, and the very most massive ones, 98%. But there would be a forest of absorption lines. Unfortunately, most people have become somewhat disappointed at the prospects for finding a strong enough background radio source at a high enough redshift to really be able to see that.
Well, of course, WMAP makes it worse, right? Before, the number you were quoting,
oh, yes,
where
you have to look
8 or 12, if you have to start looking for neutral hydrogen at 17.
That's right. But if it, you know, in this case, if there are patches that survive all the way to redshift 6, this is going to see them. You're going to see patches of the forest that are not yet eaten away. This, if we could do this, that would be great. We would be like doing Lyman alpha forest studies through reionization. And then the last point I wanted to make is that there was a paper recently by Furlanetto and Loeb, which suggested from an analytical approximation that the gas outside of mini-halos ought to be an even more stronger source of 21 centimeter background before the epoch of Lyman alpha pumping and so on in the dark ages than the mini-halos. So that we had was surprised me. Our own estimates had suggested that wasn't true, but we thought the only way to settle it is to do a simulation. So we have done simulation with gas and dark matter, and so it would take into account the Jeans mass filtering of the pre-ionized intergalactic medium. And we combined with Dong Su Ryu so that we're using the his TVD particle mesh simulations. And the examples I'm going to show you are with 512 cube cells and 256 cube particles, but we've now done 1024 cube cells and 512 cube particles and analyzing those. So the picture I'm going to show you at a redshift of 8 is to compare, and then I'll show you the plot at all red, I mean the line drawing for different redshifts. This is the map in a 0.7 megaparsec box co-moving today, as it would be if as it would be seen at redshift to 21 centimeter from redshift 8. Not, you know, no smoothing, no beams to smooth with here, just showing you the actual unfiltered, unsmoothed data from the numerical simulation. Now I look at only, I take out all the mini halos. I chop them up. And I see that. And so of course if you look, you see holes where there were mini halos. And then I get rid of the gas outside of mini halos and I show you only the mini halos. And I think you can see visually that there is a much stronger signal and a much stronger contrast from the mini halos than from the gas outside the mini halos.
What was the analytic argument for claiming that there is more signal from gas outside the mini
halos? They did a kind of press sector thing and they said for every delta crit that tells me how much mass is inside the collapse regions, like mini halos, there is a lower delta that tells me that there's gas outside of mini halos, which ought to be somehow, in some vague way, shock heated in filaments, so that it could be Lyman alpha. So it could be collisionally pumped.
I think they just say there's a lot more gas.
There's more gas at low over density.
Yes, but it has to be. It's not enough for it to be low over density. It has to be shock heated. This is
why does it need to be shocked?
Because that plot I showed you of the decoupling of the spin temperature from the CMB is not efficient at over densities of order 10. It has to be over, I mean, with temperatures that are sub CMB. Remember that without heating, the kinetic temperature of the gas is too low. So they have to say there is going to be this, you know, outside of outside of virialized halos, there are going to be filament shocks and small-scale stuff, and that ought to...
I think they were just trying to use analogy to the WIM, right? Because, like, you know, the WIM today, the shock heater gas, which is outside virialized halos, I think that was analogy.
Yeah, but it's not the same universe. It's a completely different universe today.
Well, I mean, it's a self-similar process.
So what's the reason...
Well, anyway, the simulation either found it or didn't, okay? So here's the answer, and then we can talk about why. Well, I didn't. So here's the mean brightness temperature of the box at different redshifts. And here's the total. Here's the halo contribution. Here's the IgM, everything outside of halos, when I excise the halos. And here's what a uniform IgM would do. And you can see that at the mean brightness temperature is dominated by mini halos for all redshifts less than 20. For redshifts greater than 16, the IgM contribution changes from emission to absorption. And that absorption dominates over mini halo emission at a redshift greater than 20, which was not what the redshift range they were talking about, and they certainly weren't talking about absorption. But interestingly enough, what that's really telling us is that there is the effect of the mean IgM, nothing to do with shock heated gas, and that at redshifts greater than 20, you are getting absorption instead of emission, which is the same as the uniform IgM at these redshifts. And then the rest of the story was just whether numerically were we getting the right answer. Our halos are, after all, friends of friends. Halos we're chopping out. Do we know how to chop out properly? Are we somehow...
Over-chopping.
Yeah, something. So we then did an analytical treatment. Oh, also, are we resolving the internal structure of the mini halos well enough to use or to compare them with the analytical TIS models? Okay, so this would sort of address your concerns. So we then did two things. We were using the numerical results for everything, and here we take all the halos that we got from friends of friends. Instead, we replace them with a TIS model for each one. And you get almost the same, you get almost the same answer. Instead of this, from the numerical results in detail, you get TIS halos, there's a little boost. And then you can say, well, maybe we're not resolving all the halos, or maybe Preschecter, which went into our analytical estimates, wasn't so good, but what's the comparison? And then when you actually use a Preschecter mass function to get the mean and the analytical halos, you boost it a little bit again. But actually, the reassuring thing is that it wasn't that different, even to do the analytical. And that's it.
But not to belabor this, but
yeah,
the halos are forming out of cool gas, right?
Absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. This is the dark ages before heating of the intergalactic medium. And so whenever we see a redshift range, we're either looking at a patch of the universe that's not heated, at when the rest of the universe is undergoing heating, or we can only be talking about an epoch, which is before anything is heated. Okay, stop there. Those were examples that were sort of taken from their web sites, so I presume so. There are now more experiments that are, LOFAR has now split, in there is now an MIT Australia 21 centimeter experiment, which will be more, I think, probably optimally designed for this than the LOFAR. LOFAR has to do all things for all of its interest groups, and their design is well advanced, and so as we learn more about what they really should have done, they can't change it. And then there's Wei-Li Pan's unbelievable sort of low-cost
garage.
You're right. You know, home-wired thing, which he claims will do as well.
Kazakhstan.
And I guess it's going to be in a part of China that has extremely low,
yeah, it's like it's
where there's absolutely no FM or TV signal that could interfere.
No people.
And where the Chinese government apparently is anxious to pump money into the economy because it's such a depressed area that it has, you know, no...
There are funny stories about these low-frequency arrays. One is that they seem to all to happen, you know, roughly at the same time. The other thing is the original LOFAR is a Dutch experiment. It's a 400-kilometer baseline, which doesn't fit in the Netherlands. So you know, it's spilling when they draw it. It always spills into Germany. And that's why they sort of all into the ocean, which is what the Dutch would probably prefer. you know, that's why MIT and Australia split, because they decided it was crazy to build such a low frequency array in the Netherlands in the first place. They wanted it in Australia, but the Dutch have only got money if it's built in the Netherlands. So that's why now there are two experiments plus one in China.
That's right. The Dutch got money only if they stay in the Netherlands, which apparently is a high...
Most of it in the Netherlands.
So they picked the ocean
or
Germany?
And the problem...
Belgium, I think they're invading Belgium.
But the problem is that
the
problem for LOFAR is that they are then in a very high radio interference background, and so they have to do all kinds of special things to take out the contamination, whereas they won't have to worry so much about this.
What's the name of the MIT/Australia experiment?
I'm sorry, I don't remember. I have it written down somewhere.
You know,
but
that's funded?
I don't know if it's fully funded, but they seem well advanced in their planning.
Yeah, that's fully funded.
Maybe he said you'd be done by like February.
Yeah, no.
He's the only one that believes that. I have to admit, but we'll see.
I don't even know what is he doing. You ask him, he's just like, take a wire.
All this is all this is being recorded. We should.
Well, I can only hear pop.
Oh, that's right.
Is that true?
Yeah.
You mean no one will know what I'm answering? What questions I'm answering?
I don't know. We can check it.
I think there's a mic up here.
So these are all fantastically designed experiments.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay.
Thanks, Paul.